You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu. If you are daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. We had a fun Le Cordon Bleu week on Instagram recently and spotlighted some very cool grads, including our friend, Chef Preeti Mistry. She has a great cookbook called Juhu Beach Club that celebrates her modern take on Indian food. You might love that book. And then let's thank Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs. Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are better than cage-free. They are, you know it, ready? Bull-free. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. Vital Farms very kindly sent us some eggs for the Cherry Bomb test kitchen. And I was making avocado toast and I was like, I really want to poach an egg to put on top of my avocado toast. So all of our pans were packed away for some reason. So I decided I was going to use a frying pan to boil the water. And then, of course, I couldn't find a slotted spoon. So I used a cheese grater. And guess what? It came out great. I couldn't believe it. I also swapped white vinegar for apple cider vinegar. I like to put a little white vinegar in the water. I know pretty much everybody does that. That's not a big secret when you're poaching eggs. But yeah, the swap worked out fine. Sometimes all it takes, I guess, is a little ingenuity and MacGyvering what you have in the kitchen. Housekeeping time. Let's talk about Cherry Bomb University, taking place in Manhattan on October 26th, 27th, and 28th at the Food and Finance High School, an actual New York City high school. It's a vocational school that trains its students for careers in the culinary world. All tickets are on sale now, and we've started to announce our incredible faculty. We've got Martha Stewart, I can't believe it, the Martha Stewart, and Christina Tosi. They will be getting honorary doctorates on Friday night. Then on Saturday, we'll be kicking things off that morning with Allison Roman. Can you believe? And then you can take classes with the likes of Sophia Rowe and Athena Calderon and many others. Then on Sunday, we've got Jenny Britton Bauer of Jenny's Ice Cream, Aaron Patankin of Ovenly, and Becca Parrish of Becca PR. We've got great ticket prices and ticket options for all of you, so visit cherrybomb.com to learn more. And we've got a great episode for you today. Our friend Rochelle Oliver is a journalist, a Caribbean food expert, and editor and founder of the new digital magazine, islandandspice.com. Write that down because I want you all to check it out. Rochelle did a special interview for Radio Cherry Bomb on location in New Orleans earlier this year with Nina Compton, the James Beard award-winning chef behind two of NOLA's hottest restaurants, Compère Le Pain and Bywater American Bistro. You might know Nina from Top Chef, but stay tuned to learn more about this unique talent. And then later in the show, I interview Rochelle to talk more about Nina and Rochelle's career. We'll be right back with Rochelle Oliver and Nina Compton after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin.
Nina Compton, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For being with me today here with Cherry Bomb. A lot of things I want to talk about is the opening of your new restaurant, mm-hmm. the Bywater American Bistro. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's opening.
Next week. Yeah.
I just saw. It's just like just announced. Like Thursday is what
Next Thursday, going for. Yeah.
So I can't believe you're even here with me right now. So thank you, really.
No, my pleasure.
For joining us. I'm going to talk about that. Let's just jump in. And mm-hmm. then we could talk about the South Carolina, Charleston Food and Wine Festival. Because I want to hear about that too. Bywater American Bistro. It's your second restaurant here in New Orleans.
Yes.
I hear opening restaurants is pretty hard and you're crazy enough to do it again. Let's talk
about that. Yeah, I never thought I was going to open a second one, but things kind of fell into place. I had the right talent. We found a space that we thought was fitting. And it's one of those things when you think you're going to open a second restaurant, it just felt right. Mm-hmm. I felt like the timing was good because our first restaurant kind of hit its stride and all cylinders are going. So I didn't want to, you know, hold back some of the talent that I had with me in that one space. So giving them pretty much their own platform mm-hmm. and their own voice. I tell other people this is not always about me, it's about the team. Mm-hmm. And giving people a chance to shine and to do their thing. And that's how it becomes, then they can do it for somebody else.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty much the goal.
So a lot of people know your first restaurant, which I always butcher the name.
Coppelepe, yes.
What you said there was really interesting to me is about how you saw Bywater American Bistro as an opportunity to expand your mm-hmm. your talent in a different way. Can you talk about how your talent was showcased at your first restaurant and how you're going to showcase it in a new way with your
right.
second restaurant?
Well, it's a different concept. Again, being in the Bywater, I live in that area. So it's that neighborhood kind of feel we wanted to have in this second restaurant where people can come and have drinks and a cocktail, a couple of snacks, some charcuterie, and just hang out. Mm. We want to have very high energy, lots of fun. It is an open kitchen, so it's going to be very interactive with the kitchen and the bar. People coming in, you know, lots of hands, you know, waving and welcoming people. And I think that's what we want, just to have a good, you know, fun, upbeat restaurant.
Yeah, so the dish that I remember that you became very popular with following your Top Chef mm-hmm. experience, it was a curry goat.
Curry goat with the gnocchi. And it's funny because curry goat is kind of like my comfort. You know, like weather like this, rainy, a little chilly, that is my comfort food. And I said, I want to put this on the menu because this is my kind of dish. I want people to enjoy the dish the way I do. So I did have Italian, French influences. I wanted to showcase that dish in a different way because a lot of people come to us and like, oh, I want to have rice with it. I'm like, no, just try with the gnocchi and let me know. But people really took on to this dish because you never know. You don't see a lot of goat on the menu. Mm-hmm. And it's the number one selling dish.
And everyone, I mean, you recall the gnocchi queen? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Gnocchi queen. And can you explain how you got that title?
It's something I developed working with Scott Conant at Scarpetta. That is Italian, so that was kind of my focus, was making pasta. And working with Scott, that was like my therapy time of making pasta. And just, I could zone out and I could do it. You know, you think about things, you think about life, and you could just take your time. There is no rush.
Oh, that does sound like a sort of Caribbean perspective.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Take it easy.
Yeah.
And so with your Bywater American Bistro, what do you think is going to be your standout dish there?
Well, we're actually, it's a funny way we're tying the two restaurants. We're going to be doing curried rabbit.
Okay.
So that's going to be a nod to the sister restaurant.
In terms of goat and rabbit, are the meats sort of similar there in terms of the cooking style?
Rabbit is more like chicken.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, but we figured we couldn't serve rabbit at Coppelepe because people are like, oh my gosh, the bunny.
Yeah.
And we said we're going to take a chance and have the curried rabbit. So.
And so you won't be kind of killing your
right.
logo.
Yes, our mascot. Yeah.
Killing the right. mascot. Can you explain a little bit more about
the food? Yeah, I think a lot of people don't know what American food is. When people think of American food, they think hot dogs, hamburgers, I don't know, chili cheese fries. Yeah. So it kind of gets a bad rap. And I think, you know, people are like, oh, why are you calling it American Bistro? I want to have that bistro setting, which is a casual, approachable setting. That's the best way I could describe it. When I talk about American food, that is pretty much, especially being in New Orleans, you have that melting pot of French, Caribbean, Portuguese, there's Irish here. It's just this big mix of everything. You have Vietnamese, and that is American cooking. People talk about, if you go to New York, it's such a big melting pot. That is America on a whole. And that's why I wanted to showcase it as American food of what we can do showcasing local grains, local seafood, local game, and making that a little more prominent in the food presence.
Yeah. When in doing the research about you, there is one interview that I found I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. It was your conflict to even go into Top Chef. And you said it would be a great opportunity to kind of sort of be an ambassador for St. Right. Lucia, which is where you're from. So I thought that was just so beautiful. And so why not do a St. Lucian restaurant? Why, you know?
Well, the thing is, I could, but I feel like, I mean, I'm born and raised there. And I feel like the food there is not approachable. A lot of people wouldn't understand. If I had to put, you know, green fig and saltfish, which is our national dish, people are going to be like, what the hell is this? Mm-hmm. Because there's some flavors and there's some types of vegetables that people are just not used to on an international platform.
Like what? I mean,
green bananas, we boil them. That is like our starch. And I love them. That's something I grew up with. But if I gave that to you, it'd be like, what is this? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like a tostone, it's boiled. So I try and kind of bridge the gap of the same flavors I grew up with, but kind of like a twist. So people can be like, okay, this makes sense.
Yeah. What do you feel your role is in bringing your culture to the table, mm-hmm. and also being relatable? Do you feel like it's important for you to impart your culture into the food? Or
yeah, I think that's a big thing for me is showing people different things or ingredients that I grew up with. I mean, not all of it is available here, but what I can get my hands on, I definitely try and showcase it. Like, for example, soursop. We have it as a dessert. And that's something that my mom used to make, was this soursop mousse. We did a riff on that for a dessert. So there's a lot of things that people don't know or are not used to, but they're like, I'll try it out. You know, like things like conch. Mm-hmm. I love conch, but you can't find conch anywhere here except at our restaurant.
Yeah.
But we try and showcase those fun Caribbean ingredients that a lot of people are not using right now.
I'm sure with soursop, I grew up with it, but I found that having to explain to people what that is. And then I'm like, wow, this is actually a very difficult fruit to explain because there's really nothing like it. So in your restaurants, when you're bringing new experiences to people like soursop, how do you explain that?
I think that comes down to staff education, because I'm not going to every table and telling them, yeah, this is the soursop, this is the conch. It's my staff. So it's a lot about educating the staff, making them taste the food, making them understand it. So when a guest says, what is soursop? How's it taste? They can say, well, it tastes like, you know, this sweet custard, creamy fruit. So at least they have some kind of knowledge going into it, instead of them saying, I don't know, being asked a chef.
I'm interested to hear your take on Caribbean food and becoming more popular as a whole in terms of entering mainstream palate.
You know, backtracking to the whole Top Chef thing is, you know, I told my mom, I'm like, Mom, this could be a chance for people to actually recognize Caribbean food, recognize St. Lucia for once, because there is such a huge audience that actually tuned to that show. And I took a chance to do that. And I think I found myself as a Caribbean chef on that show, mm-hmm. because I was trying to, you know, I worked for a lot of different chefs and I was cooking their food, their styles, their techniques. And I said, you know, maybe I just need to just do me for a while and see how that goes. But I think the point now with the way the culinary world is being structured, it's not just French or Italian or Chinese or Mexican. People are really venturing out to the Nordic cuisine. And now you start seeing Caribbean food on the table now. So I think that's a point where people are open to anything right now. Whereas before, I think it was a lot harder. Mm-hmm. You look at like the Mediterranean Israeli food, that is something that is coming to the forefront as well. But I think people that are essentially immigrants are saying, you know what, I want to cook my food, and people are actually receiving it. Whereas before it was not received, it was just like, I got to go to Chinatown, I got to go to these small little areas that have one or two restaurants doing that stuff. But now I think people are just really excited about finding out different cultures.
Would you even be comfortable being known as a Caribbean chef?
I'm proud of my background. I'm proud of, you know, cooking goat and cooking conch. Mm-hmm. Working soursop and passion fruit and mangoes and doing all these things. I love that because mm-hmm. it reminds me of home. Yeah. And that brings me closer to home every time.
It's interesting how you came to that decision on the reality show, but you were in Miami, like mm-hmm. you said, which is so, it's the second Caribbean.
Right. Yes. Yes and no. I think Miami it's very heavily Latin. And there is a very huge Haitian population. But again, I don't think that people really focus on the Haitian cooking. There's a small little restaurant called Tap Tap that's been there forever. Yeah. I love going there because you walk into that little house and they play the Haitian music and they have the Haitian drinks and it's no frills, but that's exactly what Haitian food is.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Haitian food does just not get that spotlight when people talk about, you know, Cuban sandwiches or all these things. Like, for some reason, Haitians are just not getting that attention.
Yeah. What I love about Haitian food, I lived in Miami for 13 years. So I think of all the Caribbean meals I've had, the way that the Haitians make the steamed fish.
Yeah.
And like, oh, the sauces. And there's this hot pepper that they use with the chicken and all their dishes.
Yeah.
This little pickled peppers.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. I love it. I'm still trying to figure out what it is that the Haitians do that make their food so distinct. Mm-hmm. And it's so this subtlety with the it's kind of like the spices don't hit you over the head, I feel.
That's what I love about all the different Caribbean islands. Every island is so different, but at the same time, so similar. As you go down, because it all stems from slavery.
Yeah.
And you look at somewhere like Trinidad, where there's a huge abundance of Indian slaves that settled there, and they brought all the spices, all the curries. That is a lot. You see a lot of that in Trinidad. And that is speckled through the Caribbean. We have a lot of Indian influence as well in St. Lucia. But as you go more north, there's less of that.
Yeah.
But you see more French in some islands. You see some Dutch, some Spanish. So it has like this nice little mix of similarities but differences at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you explain how the St. Lucian food distinguished itself from the rest of the Caribbean?
So St. Lucia has this mix of African, English, French, and Indian. It was half British, half French before it became independent. So you see a lot of things that we still import from England on our shelves, but we still have a lot of French cooking. Like, we make the boudin noir around Christmas time. We make some of those spice rums. So a lot of those things are still very present there. And it's just great because now people, again, they're starting to understand the whole farm-to-table thing, which is something we grew up with.
Yeah.
But it's a bigger focus now. You see a lot of like the fresh fruit stalls and people. You have the butcher shops on the weekends that have the half pigs and the cows hanging out. So it's like that fresh farm to table is something we grew up with forever.
Yeah. Are you the most recognizable name out of St. Louis? When you go home, are you the celebrity?
I mean, a lot of people, they see me and they know me. It's a small island.
Yeah.
You know, and people knew who I was as a child because they knew we all have very strong genes and we all look alike. Mm-hmm. We all look like my dad. So like, oh, you must be a Compton. I'm like, yeah. They're like, which one are you? Are you Jenny? Are you Maya? Are you Fiona? Are you Nina? So it's one of those things where it's just nice to be recognized. And, you know, we have a lot of St. Lucians that actually come to the restaurant to show support. It's people that drove from Florida, from Texas, just to come and have like lunch or dinner to say that they came. So I think for me, that's just a really nice feeling because it's they're proud.
Yeah.
You know, that somebody is actually showcasing things that they grew up with.
And what does that feel for you? How does that reside in you?
I think it's more of it's a blessing because it shows that people, they're happy. They're cheering you on, like, you know, keep on pushing. And people tell me that, like, not just from St. Lucia, but people from Jamaica, from Trinidad, Grenada, Dominica, that come to the restaurant, they say, you know, we're so proud of you. Yeah. Thank you for doing this. And that says to me volumes.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm giving them a voice.
Yeah. And a home to be at, to a home to stay and feel comfortable. And you said food is home.
Yeah.
And I love how you're saying that kind of being here in New Orleans, you wanted to create food that made you feel like you're at home.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, when my first time I brought my husband to New Orleans, we were here for Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just the two of us, our first Thanksgiving together. And he planned the trip and he booked our Thanksgiving at your restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, well, it was the only place I could find that had a Caribbean food. Mm-hmm. And so I thought you might like that and make you feel at home. And it did.
Good.
And so thank you for that Thanksgiving meal.
Yeah, it's... I always try, and holidays are a very fine line because we don't celebrate Thanksgiving at home.
Yeah.
But I try and incorporate some of those flavors because a lot of people just don't eat jerk turkey.
Yeah. But if you're Caribbean, that's kind of around
what you expect.
That's what you expect around the table.
Yeah.
I mean, it is that fusion, and it seems like you're doing a really good job with that. But you started talking about being at home, and I'm like, wait, you've already done that for me.
Yeah.
You've already made me feel at home. I think it's great that you represent St. Lucia, and it seems like you're very, you understand that, what that means for people.
Yeah.
When you come up with a dish, I'm circling back at the Bywater American Beach Show. Sorry to be jumping around. How you've been able to just meld all these worlds together. I was wondering if it, does it come naturally, or is it an intentional, focused thought of, I have to bring these worlds together?
I think it comes naturally. I think it's one of those things where it just falls into place. And I think it's not forced. I don't say, oh, I have to do this, or I have to put this on, or I think this would make sense. It just happens where it's just by inspiration. You know, if I get like beautiful local shrimp, I figure, how would I eat this at home? How would I do this back in St. Lucia? So those are the ways I try and tie those things in. And sometimes it does apply, sometimes it doesn't, but it just has to make sense.
It seems as though there was a time for chefs where you really did have to force yourself to like be Italian or go into this French world to actually be recognized as a legitimate chef.
Right.
And it just seems now, and you're a great example of that, of how just easing into who you are.
Right. And I think that is why when we came up with Bywater American Bistro, we didn't want, because people ask, what's the food? I'm like, contemporary American. Because I didn't want to get pigeonholed into Caribbean or French or Italian or whatever it is. I didn't want to have a category. I wanted to just come in and cook whatever I wanted. And whatever's in season, not where, I mean, I've worked in so many restaurants that I worked in an Italian restaurant, I could not use soy sauce or fish sauce. I couldn't use ginger because it's not Italian. I couldn't use lemongrass. I couldn't use coconut milk. So all those things, it kind of like restricts you because it doesn't make sense in that cuisine. So when you have this broad category where you can say, I can cook whatever I want, I think it makes that chef a little more creative because he can just do whatever he wants. There's no like breaking the rules here.
Is there sometimes a fear, though, of when chefs can go in there and just cook whatever they want, be whoever they want? Is there a fear that without that clear boundary that you could get lost, or a customer might not understand what they're coming to get?
Yes. I think a lot of chefs do not find restraint.
Yeah.
I did go through a point where I felt like I had to have 25 ingredients on the plate and a this and a that and all these things. And then I said, no, I don't, I doesn't need, does it really need all of this? And I think sometimes you have to really sit back and say, does it make sense on the plate? Does it really add anything? And then you start to just chip away on those things. But I think a lot of people can get caught up and they go overboard.
I keep bringing up Top Chef because that's how people first, you were kind of introduced to the world. You were introduced to the world on Top Chef. And now you're two restaurants out from there.
Yeah.
How would you say you've grown? For the people who've eaten at your restaurants, had experienced your cuisine, to where you are now, how have you grown as a chef?
I think I've grown as a chef just getting back to the basics. I think we've accomplished a lot in under 3 years. We're still striving to be consistent every day. I think that's the biggest thing for us. But getting people on the same page is definitely the most important thing because, you know, now I have two restaurants. And how do you get everybody on the same page and see what you want things to look like or to taste like? So we definitely, that's a very big thing for us.
Is that a struggle to just keep the foundation strong?
Yeah.
Is that what you meant by the basics?
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel like they have to, they don't have the foundation set up. And then they try and expand and do all these things. And then before you know it, they're like, oh, well, we didn't have the foundation. So now things are starting to slip by. But if you have that core fundamental in place, I think that makes it a very big difference.
A lot of people are getting into the food space right now. What do you think is missing from the food conversation right now?
The biggest thing for me is people have respect for food. I think people can abuse things sometimes and not take, for example, the overfishing. If people just said, you know what, let me just cut back on that a little bit, let the population double in numbers. It comes down to education. I think a lot of people are missing it. Where it comes down also to producers, where the customers who are the last one to find out that things are right or things are wrong. I think that's a really big thing that people need to know where their food is coming from. That's big.
That's a new role for chefs. How are you tackling that in the kitchen day to day?
It's tough. I mean, like we're talking about that documentary about the peeled garlic. When I found out, the first thing I did, I came to my kitchen and opened up the fridge and there's the peeled garlic from that company.
Yeah.
You know, and I called up my vendor. I'm like, I don't want to use this garlic anymore because it's not, morally, I don't feel I can do it. And I think it comes down to people playing their part of, I mean, we're not going to change things overnight, but wherever you can make those adjustments to not let these industries grow and thrive, that's not right. That's destroying the world.
And good with the expansion of the food space, what do you think we're doing right?
I think we're at the point right now that is, it's for a chef.
Yeah.
People that are dining out more often, and they're more adventurous, and they are reading more about food and restaurants and cuisines and about the chef. So I think that's a beautiful thing, because it's not just a handful of people. It's collective. People are, they don't have time to cook at home. So they're dining out for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So that for us as a chef, it keeps the restaurants busy, and it gives us a platform to become more creative. So if you know you have regulars, you can say, oh, you know, she's coming in tonight, I'm going to make her a special dish. So that's a great time, because people are more receptive to different things.
Why New Orleans?
It reminded me of home.
Yeah.
I think a lot of similarities here are back home. The buildings, for one, was a very big factor for me, because they're colorful, little wooden cottages. Those are things you see back home. The culture, the music, the food, those things, for me, it's about the quality of life. You know, I'm not getting any younger, and I'm not it's about finding that circle of friendship and people that make you happy, you know?
And lastly, there's this great little post you put on Instagram about your mom, and she found the spoons.
Oh, she did. Yeah. So we went to Paris, myself, the chef at Babs, and my husband. We went to Paris last July, and we had all these different restaurants, and we were making notes of things that really inspired us. And Levi, who's the chef at Babs, he's like, I really want those wooden spoons for this dish. And we found some, and I'm like, oh, those are really expensive. And I'm like, maybe I'll ask my mom if she can get somebody to make them. She was so funny, because she's like, is this the right size? How long do you want it? And she's like calling me every day. And I'm like, Mom, it's just wooden spoons. It was just nice that she finally brought them, actually, this trip, because they are handmade in St. Lucia. And that is something that it makes me happy, because that's something that is actually a dying craft back home, because a lot of people are not buying or appreciating those things. And if I could bring more stuff in, I would do it, because there's just so much arts and crafts that people just don't appreciate. Mm.
And again, that just goes back to, I think, the importance of, I mean, the role that you play, not just as a chef, not just as a Caribbean chef,
right,
not just as a female chef,
yeah,
but the potential growth and opportunities that you can bring to the spoon makers.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully it will revitalize the industries, but it's something that you see in our market, that you see produce and fish and vegetables. And there's a whole section with like straw bags that they make by hand, or hats and spoons and plates and all these things. But a lot of people just don't buy them. And it's just, it'd be nice to get that kickstarted again.
Mm. It's easy to call yourself a chef, but how do you define who you are?
I think I'm a little helper. You know, it's not just about me. It's about helping people, showcasing them, whether it's buying produce from a farmer from down the street that has beautiful produce that she's very passionate about, helping her get some kind of income, building a team, giving them a little bit of a spotlight as well, and just getting people to be aware of different things that I am very passionate about.
Nina Compton, thank you so much
for
being with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And best of luck with the opening
thank
of Bywater American Bistro opening Thursday.
Yes.
So congratulations to
that. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back with journalist Rochelle Oliver of islandandspice.com. Does this happen to you? You need a dozen eggs. You go to the supermarket, you head to the egg section, and you are so confused by what you find there, you freeze. You want nice eggs on hand, because maybe you want a cheese and herb omelet for dinner, or you want to poach an egg to slip on your avocado toast, and you know quality eggs make a big difference. And you're a decent person, so it's important that chickens have a good life. But as you stand there, you think to yourself, I have no idea what all these words on the egg cartons mean. So you shrug, pick one, and continue shopping. Stop right there. You are a busy lady. You don't need this bull in your life. You need bull free eggs, which is where Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs come in.
Their pasture-raised hens roam outside in 108 square feet of space per hen. Those cage-free hens, they never go outside. I tasted the difference once I tried Vital Farms eggs. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. And super happy to see you today and talk to you a little bit more in depth about what you are up to right now and also about the interview you very graciously did for us with Nina Compton.
She's such an amazing woman. You know, she's one of these women who, you know, she's in New Orleans and, you know, at the time she was a James Beard Award, like just a finalist. Now she's, she won, right? She's best chef of the South. And she does this great food. She's a top chef contestant. She's called the Gnocchi Queen. And then she's also Caribbean. So I, you know, when I had the opportunity to talk to her and I spoke to you about it and you said, go have at it, I was so honored, really, to be able to share this moment of meeting Nina Compton, you know, for the first time with Cherry Bomb. So thanks for that opportunity.
Well, we were so excited. And you are sort of dividing your time these days between New Orleans and New York. And it is always frustrating to me. There are these incredible women across the country that we just never get to talk to for the radio show because they don't come here that often or we don't go there. So thank you for doing that for us because Nina's having an amazing year.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, you talk about the new restaurant she opened, Bywater American Bistro.
Correct.
But you talked to her before the Beard Awards. So it's just been a really, it had to have been a great summer for her. So you have been to both her restaurants.
Yes.
I have only been to Compère Le Pain. Tell us about Bywater American Bistro.
So Bywater American Bistro, you know, when I sat down with her, I was trying to get that whole vibe, that bistro vibe, and she wanted to be relaxed. She wanted to be welcoming. You know, she says she wants people to just come in there and the hands are waving. And I have to tell you, like I've gone back a number of times now. And when you go there, you do feel like you're at home. You get to talk to the chefs. It's that open kitchen feel. And you're just interacting with the chefs and you can point over the counter and say, what's that? And they're excited to share with you their dishes. And there's a lot of art on the walls, you know, from local artists. And it just has that great New Orleans feel. It has a great, you know, that Caribbean laid back, just casual dining. But the food is otherworldly, really, and the creativity. You know, I was happy to see that her talk about it, but I was even happier to see it being delivered. You know, because I mean, it's a hard thing when you have a dream and then you can actually achieve that dream.
I'm laughing because you said, and even happier to see it delivered. I thought you meant like delivered personally to your table on a plate.
Oh, delivered, meaning like, well, that too. I mean, I've gone there so many times and you look at the food, it's beautiful. But I also find that sometimes, you know, when you're doing something different, which I feel like Nina is doing something that I haven't seen at other restaurants, and the way that she brings in her Caribbean background in a way that's accessible, in a way that's beautiful, in a way that's also just so New Orleans and bringing so many things together, it's hard to do complex. You know, it's hard to do that and be able to just whittle it down in a way that makes sense visually in the restaurant, in the food, the way it tastes, the experience, and have just like a very, you know, you go there, you show up and you have a great meal and, you know, it they make it seem easy. But when restaurants can do it well and when executive chefs can do that so well, I mean, that's an art.
Absolutely.
And so delivering on that, you know, it's everyone's dream, but few actually can do it and do it well.
So Compère Le Pain, I remember going there and you see the Caribbean influences. Absolutely. Are they as overt or obvious at Bywater?
I think she finds a way to celebrate her Caribbean background in different ways. It is an American bistro, which I think for her, and she talks about there, was just really being able to put a lot of the food, different types of food on the plate, being able to you know, try out ingredients that you wouldn't have been able to do if it was Italian or if it was French or in a box. So she really, when she opened Bywater American Bistro, you know, she explains that she wanted to have the freedom to, you know, be creative. And I think that that's what's accomplished at BABS, which is the moniker of, you know, BAB.
You like, they like the monikers down there, NOLA,
yes.
BABS. So I think it's so interesting that she found her home in New Orleans because she was working in Miami when Top Chef happened and she competed in the New Orleans episode and decided to stay and put down roots there. And New Orleans is such a melting pot and such a unique place in America. I mean, easily one of the most unique places in this country. So I think it's so interesting to go down there because there is a big Italian influence. There's a big Vietnamese influence. And now she's adding this whole other layer to the culinary scene.
Yes, certainly. It is, you know, when I asked her why New Orleans, and she competed in Top Chef and then loved it so much, she decided to stay. But when you go down there, I live down there now because it tugs at my heartstrings for one reason or another. And I think it wasn't really until my interview with Nina that I realized it is pulling on my Caribbean heritage as well. My family's from Jamaica. And when you're there, it has this sort of laid back feel that allows you, I think, sometimes to be fully who you are and try, you know, creatively try new things. As a journalist, as a writer, I enjoy being and creating in that atmosphere. The buildings, everything, the buildings, the way people talk, the neighbors, it has that sort of warmth that the Caribbean has. So I understand why she feels like she's at home there.
It also is an interesting scene for women in food because you do have Susan Spicer, who's been down there for a while. You have Kelly Fields, who opened Willa Jean. And then you have the OG Leah Chase,
yes.
From Dookie Chase Restaurant. So it's not a city that people automatically think of when it comes to women in food. But I think Kelly being there and now Nina being there, you know, it's getting a little bit more attention for that.
There's just so many great restaurants there. And there's a wonderful butcher even. And I love going into her restaurant and seeing, like, it's a place where I think that chefs can really grow.
And New Orleans is so interesting because you have restaurants that have real legacies behind them, like places that have been mm-hmm. around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And you can have careers in restaurants down there. You know, New Orleans is just so interesting. What made you decide you were going to split your time between New York and New Orleans? What do you like about it?
It is that graciousness that I love about New Orleans. It's that ability where people can just be themselves, be very honest and open, kind of have their walls down and create great work. That's what draws me, and I think a lot of people to New Orleans for one reason or another. The city is kind of like moving poetry in a way. It's so nice to have that and be in that.
So let's talk about what you've been up to professionally. You are working on an online magazine.
Yes.
Can you tell us about it?
Yes, I can. And by the time that the podcast runs, it's going to be live. Islandandspice.com. It's the place to go to hear about modern Caribbean cuisine. We celebrate the chefs. We celebrate the food, the culture, the heritage of these great recipes. But there's so many amazing chefs, Nina included. Can't wait to have her in the magazine. It's a place where we can celebrate these chefs that are really taking these recipes and doing new and great things with them, but still preserving and respecting the ingredients and where these dishes come from. How the magazine came about is an interesting story because I ran a story about the Jamaican beef patty for the New York Times.
Which wound up being semi-controversial.
It got a lot of attention on Twitter. It got a lot of attention on Twitter. And I don't think we were expecting that. But
people tell us about all the
also what was all that the buzz story, about yeah. The excitement. So the story of the Jamaican beef patty, I mean, there was this amazing evolution where it started in Jamaica and the countryside of Jamaica, and people would just kind of make it at home, make it the way that, you know, I would think like a, you know, kidney pie is made, and I really just wanted to showcase how the beef patty had moved from being this sort of like humble snack to becoming a snack really here in America. It was popular and it has been popular on the coastal regions for some time, but now we're seeing companies like Golden Crust, which is you know, Jamaican owned, and a lot of other establishments, very popular, you know, a lot of them are distributed right here out of Brooklyn. You know, they're moving to the Midwest, and people who are coming to know Caribbean food they're falling into the understanding of this snack called the Jamaican beef patty, and they're loving it. And so it's really interesting to see how more cultures, more people, you know, within the American setting are embracing this Jamaican beef patty. There's really nothing controversial about that. But what is so interesting about food, and what I know a lot of the listeners already understand, is that food is personal, and it's so intimate. When people don't realize that, here's what I tell people. Food is intimate. The first food that we all consume is from our mother's breast. And that is why food is personal. It's always been that way. And when we see someone else kind of, you know, taking that, or what seems like they're taking it or enjoying it, sometimes it doesn't feel like, hey, you know, it doesn't feel like home. And so I think that was the initial reaction. Sometimes people felt, wait, this beef patty has been around forever. Why are you just discovering it? But we weren't really discovering it. The truth is, more and more people are, you know, learning about this dish. The key element in the story, though, is how it's a lot of Jamaican business owners are the ones who are pushing the patty to become the next burger in many ways. They want it to be the grab-and-go food of America. And in many ways, the beef patty has become an ambassador for a food ambassador of sorts for the country. But I understand food is personal, and I respect people's opinions and feelings. And what I think is really great about this story, it was written by a Jamaican, me. I did do a lot of efforts to interview Jamaican business owners and Caribbean business owners and really just showcase their stories and their dreams. And it's so wonderful that America is a place that you can come to and live out your dream here and still, you know, pay respect to your own cultures. So that story, you know, a lot of people loved it. A lot of people kind of, you know, were a little upset about it. But at the end of the day, I think I won everyone over. I mean, I'm not saying that in a cocky way, but if you go back and look at the tweets, you'll see that I think people start to understand that, wait, this is a good thing. This is about sharing our culture with people. I think it's difficult when you're not familiar, when you're not used to seeing your culture kind of plastered there in the mainstream America. But the article is good.
Now, at the time, you were a breaking news editor.
I was
at the New York Times,
yeah.
And you were doing the food coverage on the side. You decided to make writing about Caribbean cuisine more of a full-time venture.
Yeah, I the success of the beef patty article, I went back to Sam Sifton, who runs the food section for the New York Times, and I had several pitches from him, and he kind of said this, like, oh, these are great, but you could do better. Which that's exactly what you want to hear from your editor. As an editor, that's your job, to challenge your reporters and to get them to move forward. And in that conversation, he says, you know what, I want you to cover Caribbean food for us. And so I thought, wow, what an interesting idea, covering Caribbean food as my beat. Even in that moment, I found myself not even regarding my own Caribbean heritage as worthy enough to be covered as a beat. Just like, you know, it was a moment where I could even, you know, put myself in the reader's shoes and say, but wait, this is my culture. This is my heritage. What do you mean covered as a beat? Caribbean is not a beat. It's interesting because I really understood, you know, being on like that flip side there.
So I have to ask, I can't even imagine how stressy being a breaking news editor is, let alone these days. What was that job like?
It's being a journalist now is definitely very difficult, but you don't get into journalism because it's easy. Being a breaking news editor at the New York Times during, you know, the time of the elections and, you know, and also I was on the national desk when, you guys remember when the Charleston church shootings happened, when Sandra Bland died in jail. It was the 10-year anniversary of Katrina. It was the 1-year anniversary of the Ferguson riots. It was, you know, a very difficult time. So I think that the journalism part is to be expected. It is a tricky thing, though, when you're covering issues that hit so close to home. But at the end of the day, you're a journalist, and you're a journalist for the New York Times. So, you know, you do the story, you get it right, and, you know, you serve, no matter what I'm doing, I just always try to serve the truth, serve the story, and let the voices, you know, come through and let the voices be heard.
I'm super excited to learn more about Caribbean cuisine and all these countries. And I think it's definitely overdue. And I think a lot of us are going to have a great time reading Island and Spice and just learning from you and learning about these ingredients and people like Nina, who is amazing. Mm-hmm. If you find yourself in New Orleans, please go visit her at Compère Lapin and Bywater American Bistro. What a wonderful career she's had so far, and we're really excited to see what's next for her and to see what's next for you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for stopping by. We're hopefully going to hear from you again soon, and maybe Nina won't be the last of the interviews that you do for us.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, I'd love to be back. It's great working with you.
Good. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Nina Compton and Rochelle Oliver. Don't forget, Rochelle's new online magazine, Island and Spice, is now live. And if you find yourself in New Orleans, like I said, be sure to visit Compère Lapin or Bywater American Bistro and say hi to Nina. Tell her you're part of the Bomb Squad. Thank you to our sponsors, Vital Farms Pasture-Raised Eggs and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School. Thank you to our associate producer, Jess Seidman, our very own Riot Girl, and to the band Cha-La-La for our theme song. If you are interested in Cherry Bomb University, and who's not, right? Come on. Taking place at the end of October, October 26th, 27th, and 28th, visit cherrybomb.com. I would love to see you smart cookies there. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.